A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
As President-elect Trump begins talking with foreign leaders, conflicts of interest related to his business are arising fast. And what are we thankful for on this unusual Thanksgiving weekend? Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. And David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is our special guest. Welcome, everybody. So President-elect Trump has started having these conversations with foreign leaders, and some awkward stories are emerging from those conversations. Trump reportedly spoke with Nigel Farage, that's the leader of Britain's right-wing UK Independence Party, about how he would like unsightly wind farms not to be constructed near his Scottish golf course. In an interview with the New York Times, Trump allowed that topic might have come up in the conversation. An Argentinian journalist alleged that when Trump spoke with the president of Argentina, he brought up a permitting issue with regard to an office building he's involved in developing in Buenos Aires. Though I should note, both Trump's campaign and the Argentinian president's office deny that they spoke about this. Then there was Trump's meeting with his Indian business partners, which we only learned about through the Indian press, the Filipino economic envoy to the U.S. who's in business with Trump, and the story about Trump's D.C. hotel pitching itself to foreign diplomats who see staying there as a good way to curry favor with the president. And then there's the fact that Trump's children have been actively participating in the transition, even though Trump has said he'll put his assets in a blind trust managed by his kids, a terminology that seems to challenge the meaning of the word blind. David, you've been very focused on these stories, not just as frustrating graft, but as alarming. Why are you so alarmed about this particular aspect of the coming Trump presidency?
Well, let me add two factual elements to the excellent summary you just presented. While both the Argentine president and Donald Trump have denied that they talked about Trump's building in Buenos Aires, as a matter of fact, it was announced on Wednesday that the previous obstacles to construction of that building have all mysteriously vanished, and the building is now going to go immediately into full-scale production. So whatever was discussed, the result is just what you might expect if they had discussed it. At the same time, we have learned that Donald Trump sent his son, Don Jr., to meet with a group of pro-Russian Syrians apparently perhaps with the Russian foreign minister as well, to discuss, to negotiate an approach to the Syria conflict. So the mingling of family and government work only continues to accelerate. The opportunities for wrongdoing are overwhelming. And as the Argentine story shows, a lot of this will never be spoken of. Things will just happen. And there will be an acceleration of the Trump family business in ways that are going to look a lot like foreign governments bribing the president of the United States, that may look also like the president of the United States, by the way, extracting benefits. Because the United States is the most powerful state on the planet. There's potentially something very predatory about what is happening here. People may not want to pay these bribes. The bribes may be extracted. But in a lot of cases, especially in countries where bribery is a way of life, like China, the bribes will just flow, or the gratuities will flow. These are theoretically illegal, but as we are reminded by the acquittal of former Virginia Governor Bob McConnell, American courts impose an extremely high standard of proof for bribery. It is not enough to show a quid and a quo. You actually have to prove the pro, that this quid is the reason for that quo. So merely having the favor on one side and the sack of cash on the other is not enough.
The thing I'm wondering is, as all these stories come out, is Did Trump's voters expect anything different here, and are they going to be outraged as this starts to happen? Because, I mean, Trump said in the campaign that he was going to have his kids run the business. It's not like there's a surprise that there are all these conflicts of interest. It would frankly be really difficult for him to liquidate his business empire. The brand that is the core value of the business is only really valuable if he's in some way appearing to be involved in the business. Real estate assets are very difficult to liquidate. So I don't think people were expecting that he was going to sell off the assets, put them in a truly blind trust in liquid investments that he doesn't even know what they are. The people who chose him to be president seem to have chosen this arrangement. So I guess my question, Rich, is this something that's actually going to outrage people? What would he have to do to be breaking the pact that he had made with voters?
I don't think anything he is going to do anytime soon is going to break that pact with his base. And I don't think there's really any prospect of the Republican Congress passing anything new to deal with this. One thing that I was surprised by, I had no idea prior to these controversies that these conflict of interest laws don't technically apply to the president of the United States, which seems a bizarre lacuna in such laws. But he has a national base. He won a national election, and Republican congressmen are going to be very loath to cross them unless and until there is some sort of not kind of, you know, low smoldering smoke associated with this thing, but some real catastrophic scandal where there's evidence of a real quid pro quo. As David points out, a lot of this is just going to happen naturally. If he asked the Argentine president for anything, for approvals for that project, he certainly didn't have to. I think it would have happened in the normal course of business. And Trump never made the emotional intellectual leap to giving up his business. He continued to run his business as he ran a successful campaign for president. We're kind of in uncharted territory here.
Dahlia, what do you think the recourse is? I know a lot of people have been talking about the emoluments clause to the United States Constitution, not ordinarily a top topic of conversation in constitutional analysis. Is this a thing that matters for what Donald Trump is about to do?
It doesn't roll off your tongue, does it?
No.
Emoluments.
Emoluments.
Many of us who've written about the Constitution for decades are learning about it for the first time. No, it provides no recourse for exactly the reasons that I think Rich just stated, that there is no statutory stop here. What there is if you want to say, and I think a lot of scholars have said, look, there's this clause in the Constitution. It's called the Emoluments Clause. You can't get rich from foreign princes and dignitaries, anything above market value, say the experts on that he gets from anyone violates the clause. And you know what the recourse is? Impeachment. And nobody is going to impeach President Trump for violations of the Emoluments Clause. And there's even some folks who say, oh, he's not really technically in violation of it anyway, and maybe it doesn't even apply to the president. So constitutional scholars are going to wring their hands over this for 4 years, and it's going to make no difference.
David, to your point about the difficulty of proving bribery in U.S. courts, I think the key question here is not so much a legal standard as when the electorate is likely to care. And what I'm watching for is if people are concerned about quid pro quos, they're going to be more upset about the quo than the quid. Like, if you see Donald Trump getting rich in real estate projects abroad and other foreign leaders being nice to him, I think a lot of people will look at that and say, well, that's what Donald Trump does. He's a good, savvy real estate developer and he negotiates deals. On the other hand, if people start seeing things the U.S. government does that is favorable to foreign countries in which Donald Trump is developing real estate, things that might be costly to the U.S., military aid, foreign policy decisions that cause trouble with other allies that we have, that seems like the pain point where you might get voters saying, hey, Donald Trump isn't just getting rich. He's doing something to the rest of us in order to get rich.
Right. But look, on to that second point. The president of the United States is so vastly powerful person, he can get a lot of mileage out of simply refraining from doing things that are hostile to a certain country. You don't have to take money from China and do a benefit to China. You can take money from China, and by the way, not the Chinese state, because that, as you say, follows the file of the Emoluments Clause, but entrepreneurs in China who discover a sudden passionate interest in building a lot, in franchising the Trump name for 100 Trump hotels and casinos across that vast country. And then you hold back actions that you might otherwise have taken. So go prove that the reason the president didn't brand China a currency manipulator was that there are suddenly a lot more Trump hotels, although we will all suspect. But I want to say something about the first half of what you just said, because this points to a real structural flaw in which people like us who talk on these shows, not us, of course, I'll exempt that, but a mistake we often make. One of the standard moves in cable TV debate is to say the great and good American people don't care about this or that thing. And therefore, the implication is this or that thing isn't important. But there are a lot of things that are necessary to the functioning of a of a modern system. The American people are not that, the great and good American people are not that interested in making sure that, in understanding how sewage systems work or air traffic control or all kinds of other things that are fundamental to the functioning of a modern state. And that's why they deputize specialists to care about things like sewage systems and air traffic control. Well, those of us who are specialists in political systems, that's what journalists and politicians are, we have a responsibility to care as much about the clean functioning of the political system as the experts on sewage or air traffic control have to cope with theirs. And it is no excuse if you are negligent as an air traffic controller that the public isn't interested in this or that rule change. The point is you have to care about it. So I don't think we can be demoralized by when the talking heads on the pro-Trump talking heads who are proliferating around us say the American people aren't interested. It's our job to make them interested, to make them understand why the well-being of the society depends on the president of the United States not selling the power of the American state to foreign purchasers or domestic purchasers either for his own personal enrichment.
To that point, Rich, even Breitbart.com ran a piece this week about expressing some concerns about this and suggesting rather politely that Donald Trump appoint some respected outside figure, perhaps a retired judge, to report quarterly to Congress on his conflicts of interest and what he's doing to manage them. I've seen a lot in the conservative press that has been very wary of this and laying out where they see the conflicts of interest being. And I'm just wondering what role conservatives have to play here. And particularly, you said that you don't think the Republican Congress is going to be eager to do much about this. There is this committee, the Government Oversight Committee, whose job is to investigate these sorts of things. They've gone doggedly after President Obama over the last 6 years, and they were preparing for a couple of years of Hillary Clinton-related investigations. Shouldn't Jason Chaffetz, who chairs that committee in the House, be picking these topics up, and is there going to be any meaningful pressure for him to do so?
No. Jason Chaffetz will not be investigating Donald Trump's potential conflicts of interest anytime soon unless Donald Trump proves to be hugely unpopular and there's some enormous scandal. It's just not going to happen. And the pressure on Republican congressmen to get on board and help Donald Trump be successful is already enormous and is only going to grow in coming months.
Well, that's dispiriting. Dahlia, what do you see as recourse here if the emoluments clause isn't going to do much? Is there anything for us to do as we fret about this?
I mean, I think that presumably at some point these conflicts of interests are going to be so grotesque that they smack us in the face regardless of what the pundits are saying on TV. I mean, I want to believe that as, you know, Trump Tower becomes something, you know, I guess Trump is trying to turn one of his golf courses into 10 Downing Street. I don't know. I mean, I think at some point the optics may be sufficiently hideous that when coal mining jobs don't come back and manufacturing jobs don't come back, the notion that we might have a Marie Antoinette problem in this country may sort of burble up. But I don't think there are checks. And I think, you know, it's not a trivial thing that Trump told Maggie Haberman at the Times that these laws just don't apply to me. I'm the president. None of it applies to me. It was Nixon-esque. And if that kind
except
of...
Except that it was true.
Well, he's saying that the statutes, that you're right, the conflict and ethics statutes don't apply to him.
Right.
But I think that, you know, the idea that any law to him continues to be an inconvenience that he can bat away. Maybe at some point folks would care. I'm optimistic that David's right and we could get folks to care. But it just seems to me that what the press is doing right now is running around with butterfly nets trying to sort of find a story about the alt-right.
Well, let us know what you think about Trump's global hotel brand that may get more global at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Thanksgiving. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick of Slate. And David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is also with us. So depending where you are in the country, you're probably hearing this show on the Friday or Saturday after Thanksgiving. Obviously, politics is weighing a little heavier than usual on people this November, and some of the majority of Americans who didn't vote for Trump may have been stretching to focus on what they were thankful for. Though maybe that means the exercise of talking about what we're thankful for is even more important than usual this year. So I want to go around and talk about what we here are all thankful for, and I want to start by saying I'm thankful the government isn't usually as important as most people make it out to be. Now, don't get me wrong, policy is very important. There's a reason I've devoted so much of my life to talking about it. But so much of what makes people happy and healthy and satisfied is really hard to move through policy, which is part of why policy is so hard to make. I want to give an example. The Affordable Care Act seems to have been a lot less important than its supporters hoped or its opponents feared. It didn't seem to have major effects on employer-based insurance that covers most adult Americans. Conservatives feared that it would drive people out of that market. On the other hand, it didn't expand coverage to as many people as liberals hoped, and it's surprisingly hard to tease out the law's actual effects on health outcomes. Now, obviously, that's kind of a story of policy failure, but it also means that the effect of whatever Donald Trump does next on health policy is likely to be more limited than liberals fear or conservatives hope. It's especially because Trump has promised to keep part of the law, and the thing is very interconnected and complicated. He probably won't be able to change it as much as he's been promising. So that's an area where the Trump presidency is probably going to be less important than people on either the right or the left had been banking on it being. Now, obviously, that's not everything. Wars and nuclear strikes, for example, are important policy matters where individual presidents' choices can make a great deal of difference. And so there are some big, important things that I'm afraid that Trump could do that would be very, very negative. But I think the most likely case is that he will be a president with bad effects in the fairly ordinary range of presidencies, and that our lives during his presidency will go on more or less normally. And I'm thankful to at least be able to hold on to that piece of hope this Thanksgiving. So what do you guys think about that? Is that reasonable, or am I engaged in wishful thinking there?
Well, you know, one, if you're disturbed by what Trump might do or the way in particular he campaigned, one upside of the fact that his base is so firmly attached to him, it's another factor that gives him a huge amount of flexibility. And we've already seen that initially where he's basically admitted, no, we're not going to build a wall all along the border. No, I'm not going to appoint a special prosecutor to go after Hillary Clinton. And he is going to have an enormous pragmatic streak. And we've already seen it also in his video that he released on his first day agenda. It was very non-ideological, struck a very inclusive tone. It was about, you know, pursuing visa abuse and infrastructure projects and getting the country moving again in energy development, most of which I think just the median voter out there would have no problem with whatsoever.
Dahlia was making some faces there.
No, I'm only making faces. I'm only making faces insofar as, you know, I'm not sure how inclusive and big-hearted his last few days have been, and I suppose we'd be remiss if we didn't say that he's done nothing to call out the alt-righters who are sig-heiling at the Reagan building in D.C. last weekend.
Well, he did under pressure say that he disavowed them.
He did disavow them. I think he's more angry, openly, overtly angry at the cast of Hamilton than he is right now at the people who are committing acts of racism in his name. And I think this is something that seriously engenders fear in a lot of Americans. And I think it needs to be called out in a serious and ongoing way. But I guess I would just say, you know, what I'm grateful for, Josh, and I don't suppose it's all that different from what you're saying, is that despite the fact that they're depleted and exhausted, I keep encountering, you know, death penalty attorneys and women's rights attorneys, environmental warriors, you know, people who are just kind of, despite feeling gut punched, going back to work. And for me, that is pretty inspiring and pretty amazing. I think that it's, you know, to Rich's point, it's not clear to me yet that Trump is pragmatic. It is clear to me that he is vastly influenced by whoever the last person was who spoke to him. And so when he says things like, oh, today I think waterboarding is a bad idea, and I'm not sure that really global warming is a hoax, that doesn't strike me as pragmatism so much as it strikes me as magic eight ballism, and whoever's speaking to him at that moment has undue influence. So I have yet to be persuaded that he is going to be pragmatic, but I am incredibly mindful of the people who are getting into the trenches and trying to change what may come.
Hey, sometimes the magic eight ball says signs point to good. David, are you thankful for anything this Thanksgiving?
Yes. Josh, let me say first in response to you that the lovely American confidence that things will be all right is the greatest single impediment we have to things turning out all right. And that while alarmism at this point may be overstated, it's also true that the alarmism is what is going to protect us. I'm thinking of the story of Jonah. Most people know him as the whale, the man who was swallowed by the whale, the prophet who was swallowed by the whale. But the reason Jonah was inside the whale was that God asked him to go to preach to the city of Nineveh about the need to repent. And Jonah fled because he was worried about preserving his own credibility, because he said, what would happen is, I'm going to go to Nineveh, I'm going to preach to them to repent, they will repent, and then God won't destroy them, and I will look like an idiot. And so in order to preserve my own prestige, I refuse this mission. I think all of us have to be willing to do what Jonah was too cowardly to do, which is to say, we are going to have to take on the mission of being alarmist. That's the way that the alarm, by triggering the alarm, we stop the burglar. So what am I grateful for? Am I thankful for many, many things, but in the public realm, I'm above all thankful for my friends who have lived in or had experience in foreign countries, Central Europe, Latin America, where kleptocrats succeeded. And I learned from them both about the strengths of the United States, the wide distribution of power, the state's attorney general, by the way, who are going to be very important in defeating kleptocracy no matter what happens at the federal level, a free press, much of which is relatively protected against the weight of government, although much of it is not. So those strengths of the American society, but their warnings to us about how what they have seen happen in places like Hungary and Mexico, and how we should not be arrogant in believing that these things can't happen here. It's harder to do it here. It's not impossible. We belong to the same human species that everybody else does. The United States has been a lucky country, and that makes Americans tend to think there's something different about them from the rest of humanity. That's what we're testing. It's not true. We're the same people. So thanks to the warnings from others, thanks to the distribution of strengths in the American society that make it a little bit more difficult to accomplish here what has been accomplished in other places.
Well, so, Rich, David is thankful for alarm, which I guess actually does make sense in the context. What are you thankful for?
Well, in the political realm, on the Trump phenomenon, I'm thankful that we still live in a completely wide-open country. I mean, here was someone 18 months ago no one thought had any chance of being elected president of the United States, including very likely Donald Trump himself, and he hit a chord. And it happened. And that's an extraordinary thing. In the non-political realm, I think the thing that it's easiest for us to take for granted in our country, in our era, is the incredible advances in medicine every day, and particularly from the pharmaceutical industry that works major and minor miracles every single day and is just such incredible blessing, because it extends people's lives, it reduces the effect of illness on people, and just makes us more comfortable in ways that people have never been in the world ever before.
The funny thing, Rich, is I recall that's what you were thankful for on the Left, Right, and Center Thanksgiving show last year.
I'm always thankful for it.
I guess, which I guess might indicate that there was not a lot in the last 12 months that was new to be thankful for. But so on the subject of an outsider being able to come from nowhere and becoming president, and this being a uniquely American thing, I mean, is that good? Isn't there a reason that, like, I mean, president of the United States is a job with responsibilities and skills that are required for it that Donald Trump does not possess. Shouldn't we want a system that's not so wide open so that somebody like that doesn't walk into the presidency. I mean, I remember the movie Idiocracy, which is fast becoming a classic, about the society becoming dumber and dumber over 500 years, the Mike Judge comedy. The president there is some like fake wrestling star who knows nothing about anything and ends up watering all the crops with Gatorade, which salts the earth and causes a famine because they think electrolytes are good for everything. Like, it doesn't seem like the showman like outsider is necessarily a great thing to have be able to rise. I don't know, Dahlia, do you have any thoughts?
No, I'm just so grateful that Jared Kushner is going to solve peace in the Middle East. I think that his extensive knowledge in doing that sort of, I mean, I just think that the triumph of if they're related to me, they're going to be awesome is a slightly terrifying proposition. And the only thing scarier than a president who is sort of incurious and a weather vane is that instead of saying, hey, I'm going to surround myself with those cosseted intellectuals who really know how to do stuff, he instead seems to think that this is so easy that anyone who's related to him can fix it. And that's pretty terrifying.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to wait and see the sum of the remaining cabinet picks. Some of the names that have been floating out there are quite different from that. And, you know, Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, who was quite cool toward Donald Trump during the campaign, putting her in the position of ambassador to the UN, suggests to me that there might be some of these picks. I don't know that she doesn't have foreign policy experience. I don't know that she's the perfect person to be ambassador to the UN, but I take it at least as a hopeful sign that he will reach out to people who are respected in the party, who weren't necessarily loyalists to him. For example, at Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, that could do a lot of good. Oh, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. David Frum, what's on your mind?
I am never going to get past this, that we have had an election in which a hostile foreign intelligence agency played a major role. The exact magnitude of that role, we don't know, but it happened. And now we see elections in allied states, upcoming a referendum in Italy, coming election, presidential election in France, legislative elections in Germany, in which that same hostile foreign power is again playing a role. It is just too big to go uninvestigated and undiscussed. And I think Americans need to wake up to the fact that while Russia is no longer a superpower, it has become a mischievous and malign actor in international affairs that is trying to distort democratic systems around the world in order that the kleptocrats back in Russia can feel that they don't have anything to fear.
Rich Lowry.
This time of year, I always like to share a little bit from a passage from Bill Buckley, who wrote and spoke very eloquently about gratitude. And in one speech, he said, to fail to experience gratitude when walking through the corridors of the Metropolitan Museum, when listening to the music of Bach or Beethoven, when exercising our freedom to speak or to give or withheld our assent, is to fail to recognize how much we have received from the great wellsprings of human talent and concern that gave us Shakespeare, Abraham Lincoln, Mark Twain, our parents, our friends. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Dahlia Lithwick.
In very much in Rich's vein, I think that I share with David a deep, deep anxiety. I am as worried as I've ever been that my kids go to school and that there are Mexican kids who are afraid to go to school now. I think that this has been the most consequential moment for our children, and we haven't recognized what it's done to them. But I'm going to agree with Rich that what I want to say today is that I am thankful. I am thankful so very much for freedom and for the opportunity for us to hopefully work through this and to get to a better side of it. And so for me, it's all about today, thankfulness and gratitude.
For my rant, I want to touch on what David said about alarm. And I think he's right that there's going to be a lot that we need to be alarmed about over the next 4 years. But I also think we need to make sure that when we get alarmed, we have the facts right and that we don't freak out about things that turn out to be somewhat less alarming than we said, because then things that are still quite bad ideas, if they're less alarming than the thing we said, they might not get the attention they deserve. For an example, I want to point to something Rich wrote about this week, which is the so-called Muslim registry. What it looks like Donald Trump is actually likely to propose is to resurrect a Bush-era program that required men of working age from certain mostly Muslim-majority countries to register and be interviewed every time they enter the United States. I don't think this was a great program. I think the Obama administration got rid of it for a reason, but it is not a Muslim registry. Most importantly, it does not apply to U.S. citizens. And so we should have a debate about the merits of that program. But if people go around yelling, he wants a Muslim registry, and then ordinary voters see, no, actually, it's just this program that the Bush administration did before that's constitutional and there's a debate about whether it was useful, then people will say, oh, well, you told me to be really alarmed and really I should just be concerned. This isn't that important. So make sure that the warnings are out there, but also make sure
the warnings accurately reflect what it is that Donald Trump is up to. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Dahlia Lithwick, and David Frum. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Berskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by CRW.